welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Eileen Charles, and with Memorial Day fast approaching, I'm going to say something that will surprise you, so here it comes. Spend a little less time with your books and more time starting your summer shape-up. Never thought you'd hear me say that, right? But the beach and bathing suits are only weeks away. To help with motivation, I've got titles that will get you thinking about fitness and the many ways to get out there. And we'll preview books in the news about what we eat and better nutrition. I promise you'll find them fascinating, not preachy. So let's begin as we turn to page one of the book report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. Mary Roach is an author who's always willing to go there in the name of science. She tackled sexual physiology in Bonk, the life of cadavers in Stiff, and now takes on the digestive system in Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. Though the journey begins at the top and ends at the bottom of the legendary Alimentary Canal, Roach does not take us there in a straight line. There are side excursions to visit experts in the fields of, for example, morning breath and pet food engineers. Why is crunchy food so appealing? How much can you eat before your stomach bursts? And is that what killed Elvis? Emily Wu Zeller performs the book that presents this topic in a well-researched, relevant, offbeat, and oft-times hilarious way.
1. Nose job. Tasting has little to do with taste. The sensory analyst rides a Harley. There are surely many things she enjoys about traveling by motorcycle, but the one Sue Langstaff mentions to me is the way the air, the great and odorous out of doors, is shoved into her nose. It's a big, lasting, passive sniff. This is why dogs stick their heads out the car window. It's not for the feeling of the wind in their hair. When you have a nose like a dog has, or Sue Langstaff, you take in the sights by smell. Here is California's Highway 29 between Napa and St. Helena through Langstaff's nose. Cut grass, diesel from the wine train locomotive, sulfur being sprayed on grapes, garlic from Bottega Ristorante, rotting vegetation from low tide on the Napa River, toasting oak from the Demptos Cooperage, hydrogen sulfide from the Calistoga mineral baths, grilling meat and onions from Gott's Drive-In, alcohol evaporating off the open fermenters at Whitehall Lane Winery, dirt from a vineyard tiller, smoking meats at Mustard's Grill, manure, hay. Author's note, a few words on sniffing. Without it, or a Harley, you miss all but the most potent of smells going on around you. Only 5 to 10% of air inhaled while breathing normally reaches the olfactory epithelium at the roof of the nasal cavity. Olfaction researchers in need of a controlled, consistently sized sniff use an olfactometer to deliver odorant pulses. The technique replaces the rather more vigorous blast olfactometry as well as the original olfactometer, which connected to a glass and aluminum box called the camera inodorata. The subject's head was placed in the box, wrote the inventor, alarmingly, in 1921. Tasting, in the sense of wine tasting, and of what Sue Langstaff does when she evaluates a product, is mostly smelling. The exact verb would be flavoring, if that could be a verb in the same way tasting and smelling are. Flavor is a combination of taste, sensory input from the surface of the tongue, and smell. But mostly, it's the latter. Humans perceive 5 tastes: sweet, bitter, salty, sour, and umami, brothy, and an almost infinite number of smells. 80 to 90% of the sensory experience of eating is olfaction. Langstaff could throw away her tongue and still do a reasonable facsimile of her job. Her job. It's a kind of sensory forensics. People come to me and say, "My wine stinks. What happened?" Langstaff can read the stink. Off flavors, or defects in the professional's parlance, are clues to what went wrong. An olive oil with a flavor of straw or hay suggests a problem with desiccated olives. A beer with a hospital smell is an indication that the brewer may have used chlorinated water, even just to rinse the equipment. The wine flavors leather and horse sweat are tells for the spoilage yeast Brettanomyces. The nose is a fleshy gas chromatograph. As you chew food or hold wine in the warmth of your mouth, aromatic gases are set free. As you exhale, these volatiles waft up through the posterior nares, the internal nostrils at the back of the mouth, and connect with olfactory receptors in the upper reaches of the nasal cavity. The technical name for this internal smelling is retronasal olfaction. The more familiar sniffing of aromas through the external nostrils is called orthonasal olfaction. The information is passed on to the brain, which scans for a match. What sets a professional nose apart from an everyday nose is not so much its sensitivity to the many aromas in a food or drink, but the ability to tease them apart and identify them. Like this: dried cherries, molasses, blackstrap. Langstaff is sniffing a strong dark ale called Noel. We are at Beer Revolution, an amply stocked, mildly skunky bar in Oakland, California, where I have an office. In the city, not the bar, and Langstaff has a parent in the hospital. She could use a drink. And we have 4. For demonstration purposes.
We've just heard Gulp by Mary Roach. In Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation, Michael Pollan explores the uncharted territory of his own kitchen. Here he discovers the enduring power of the 4 classical elements, fire, water, air, and earth, and how they transform the stuff of nature into delicious things to eat and drink. Apprenticing himself to a succession of culinary masters, Pollan learns how to grill with fire, cook with liquid, bake bread, and ferment everything from cheese to beer. In the course of his journey, he discovers the cook stands squarely between nature and culture. The effects of not cooking are similarly far-reaching. Relying on corporations to process our food means we are consuming huge quantities of fat, sugar, and salt, and disrupting an essential link to the natural world. In fact, Cooked argues taking back control of cooking may be the single most important step anyone can take to help make the American food system healthier and more sustainable. The author performs the book.
Our culture seems to be of at least 2 minds on this subject. Survey research confirms we're cooking less and buying more prepared meals every year. The amount of time spent preparing meals in American households has fallen by half since the mid-60s, when I was watching my mom fix dinner, to a scant 27 minutes a day. Americans spend less time cooking than people in any other nation, but the general downward trend is global. And yet at the same time, we're talking about cooking more, and watching cooking, and reading about cooking, and going to restaurants designed so that we can watch the work performed live. We live in an age when professional cooks are household names, some of them as famous as athletes or movie stars. The very same activity that many people regard as a form of drudgery has somehow been elevated to a popular spectator sport. When you consider that 27 minutes is less time than it takes to watch a single episode of Top Chef or the next Food Network star, you realize that there are now millions of people who spend more time watching food being cooked on television than they spend actually cooking it themselves. I don't need to point out that the food you watch being cooked on television is not food you get to eat. This is peculiar. After all, we're not watching shows or reading books about sewing or darning socks or changing the oil in our car, three other domestic chores that we have been only too happy to outsource and then promptly drop from conscious awareness. But cooking somehow feels different. The work or the process retains an emotional or psychological power we can't quite shake or don't want to. And in fact, it was after a long bout of watching cooking programs on television that I began to wonder if this activity I had always taken for granted might be worth taking a little more seriously. I developed a few theories to explain what I came to think of as the cooking paradox. The first and most obvious is that watching other people cook is not exactly a new behavior for us humans. Even when everyone still cooked, there were plenty of us who mainly watched, men for the most part, and children. Most of us have happy memories of watching our mothers in the kitchen, performing feats that sometimes looked very much like sorcery and typically resulted in something tasty to eat. In ancient Greece, the word for cook, butcher, and priest was the same, mageros, and the word shares an etymological root with magic. I would watch, rapt, when my mother conjured her most magical dishes, like the tightly wrapped packages of fried chicken Kiev that, when cut open with a sharp knife, liberated a pool of melted butter and an aromatic gust of herbs. But watching an everyday pan of eggs get scrambled was nearly as riveting a spectacle, as the slimy yellow goop suddenly leapt into the form of savory gold nuggets. Even the most ordinary dish follows a satisfying arc of transformation, magically becoming something more than the sum of its ordinary parts. And in almost every dish you can find, besides the culinary ingredients, the ingredients of a story, a beginning, a middle, and an end. Then there are the cooks themselves, the heroes who drive these little dramas of transformation. Even as it vanishes from our daily lives, we're drawn to the rhythms and textures of the work cooks do, which seems so much more direct and satisfying than the more abstract and formless tasks most of us perform in our jobs these days. Cooks get to put their hands on real stuff, not just keyboards and screens, but fundamental things like plants and animals and fungi. They get to work with the primal elements too, fire and water, earth and air, using them, mastering them, to perform their tasty alchemies. How many of us still do the kind of work that engages us in a dialogue with the material world that concludes, assuming the chicken Kiev doesn't prematurely leak or the souffle doesn't collapse, with such a gratifying and delicious sense of closure?
That was Cooked by Michael Pollan. Vegetable Miracle, A Year of Food Life, is a departure for Barbara Kingsolver, but as always, you'll be enthralled by her thinking. When Barbara and her family moved from suburban Arizona to rural Appalachia, they took on a new challenge to spend a year on a locally produced diet, paying close attention to the provenance of everything they consumed. The book follows the family through the first year of their experiment. They found themselves eager to move away from the typical food scenario of American families, a fridge packed with processed factory-farmed foods. In their search for another way to eat and live, they began to recover what Kingsolver considers our nation's lost appreciation for farms and the natural processes of food production. Americans spend less of their income on food than any other culture in the history of the world, yet they pay dearly in other ways, losing flavor, diversity, and the creative food cultures of earlier times. The environmental costs are high, and the nutritional sacrifice is undeniable. Americans are now raising the first generation of children who will have a shorter life expectancy than their parents. Part memoir and part journalistic investigation, Animal Vegetable Miracle makes a passionate case for putting the kitchen back at the center of family life. The author shares the narration with Camille Kingsolver and Stephen Hoppe.
For 20 years, Stephen had owned a piece of land in the southern Appalachians with a farmhouse, barn, orchards and fields, and a tax zoning known as farm use. He was living there when I met him, teaching college and fixing up his old house one salvaged window at a time. I'd come as a visiting writer, recently divorced, with something of a fixer-upper life. We proceeded to wreck our agendas in the predictable fashion by falling in love. My young daughter and I were attached to our community in Tucson. Stephen was just as attached to his own green pastures and the birdsong chorus of deciduous eastern woodlands. My father-in-law-to-be, upon hearing the exciting news about us, asked Stephen, "Couldn't you find one closer?" Apparently not. We held on to the farm by renting the farmhouse to another family and maintained marital happiness by migrating like birds. For the school year, we lived in Tucson, but every summer headed back to our rich foraging grounds, the farm. For 3 months a year, we lived in a tiny, extremely crooked log cabin in the woods behind the farmhouse, listening to wood thrushes, growing our own food. The girls, for another child came along shortly, loved playing in the creek, catching turtles, experiencing real mud. I liked working the land, and increasingly came to think of this place as my home, too. When all of us were ready, we decided we'd go there for keeps. We had many conventional reasons for relocation, including extended family. My Kingsolver ancestors came from that county in Virginia. I'd grown up only a few hours away, over the Kentucky line. Returning now would allow my kids more than just a hit-and-run holiday acquaintance with grandparents and cousins. In my adult life, I'd hardly shared a phone book with anyone else using my last name. Now I could spend Memorial Day decorating my ancestors' graves with peonies from my backyard. Tucson had opened my eyes to the world and given me a writing career, legions of friends, and a taste for the sensory extravagance of red-hot chilies and five-alarm sunsets. But after 25 years in the desert, I'd been called home. There is another reason the move felt right to us, and it's the purview of this book. We wanted to live in a place that could feed us, where rain falls, crops grow, and drinking water bubbles right up out of the ground. This might seem an abstract reason for leaving beloved friends and one of the most idyllic destination cities in the United States, but it was real to us. As it closes in on the million souls mark, Tucson's charms have made it one of this country's fastest-growing cities. It keeps its people serviced across the wide, wide spectrum of daily human wants, with its banks, shops, symphonies, colleges, art galleries, city parks, and more golf courses than you can shake a stick at. By all accounts, it's a bountiful source of everything on the human need checklist, save for just the one thing, the stuff we put in our mouths every few hours to keep us alive. Like many other modern U.S. cities, it might as well be a space station where human sustenance is concerned. Virtually every unit of food consumed there moves into town in a refrigerated module from somewhere far away. Every ounce of the city's drinking, washing, and goldfish bowl-filling water is pumped from a non-renewable source, a fossil aquifer that is dropping so fast, sometimes the ground crumbles. In a more recent development, some city water now arrives via a 300-mile-long open canal across the desert from the Colorado River, which, owing to our thirsts, is a river that no longer reaches the ocean, but peters out in a sand flat near the Mexican border.
That was a sampling of Barbara Kingsolver's Animal Vegetable Miracle. In April 2009, First Lady Michelle Obama planted a kitchen garden on the south lawn of the White House. It is a garden with roots in the American past, stretching back to George Washington. But it is also a garden designed for America's future. As fresh vegetables, fruit, and herbs sprout from the ground, the First Lady hopes the kitchen garden will inspire a new conversation across the country about the food we feed our families and the impact it has on our health and well-being. In American Grown, the story of the White House kitchen garden and gardens across America, Mrs. Obama shares this story from the planting to the harvest. As a novice gardener, she struggles and revels in her crop, and she includes unique recipes created by the White House chefs. Mrs. Obama, who narrates, also shares stories of other gardens that have moved and inspired her. Tales include a modern-day vegetable truck that brings fresh produce to underserved communities in Chicago, Houston office workers who made the sidewalk bloom, a New York City school that created a scented garden for the visually impaired, and a North Carolina garden that devotes its harvest to those less fortunate.
How times have changed.
Life in my old neighborhood has changed a great deal since I was young. At my old elementary school, as in many others across America, outdoor recess has been eliminated, and many kids no longer walk to school. While my parents never thought twice about sending us outside to play, parents in that neighborhood today worry about letting their kids venture too far out of their sight. And kids there, like everywhere these days, are probably a lot more likely to huddle around a video game console than join in a game of Double Dutch. Parents today are squeezed from every direction, always racing to the next appointment, the next carpool pickup, the next errand on their list. I've been one of those mothers, anxiously looking at my watch while waiting in the drive-through lane or popping something into the microwave while finishing up a conference call. But I had never really thought of the consequences until I sat down with our family pediatrician and he asked me a simple question: what are you eating? He then started telling me about how some families in his practice ate every meal, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, at a different convenience food chain. Aside from a piece of pickle or sprinkle of shredded lettuce on a hamburger, they had hardly any fruits and vegetables in their diets. He talked about the spike in the number of his young patients who were overweight or even obese. He spoke of kids around the country who were developing adult lifestyle diseases, elementary school students being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, and high schoolers already on blood pressure medication. In recent years, the problem has only gotten worse, and today, roughly 1 in 3 American children are overweight or obese. That moment was a wake-up call for me. Until then, I thought my husband and I were doing everything we could to give our daughters every opportunity in their lives. We read to them and made sure they did their homework. We signed them up for sports, music lessons, and dance classes. But after talking with their doctor, I realized that we weren't giving them one of the most fundamental advantages they could have: a truly healthy lifestyle. So we decided to make some changes. We started small, emptying our pantry of unhealthy foods and filling our glasses with water and skim milk instead of sugary drinks. We ate at home more often.
That was American Grown by Michelle Obama. On to fitness. In It's All About the Bike, The Pursuit of Happiness on Two Wheels, Robert Penn has saddled up nearly every day of his adult life. In his late 20s, he pedaled 25,000 miles around the world. Today, he rides to work, to travel, to go shopping, and to stay sane. So when the time came for a new bike, he pulled out all the stops. He would build his dream bike, the bike he would ride for the rest of his life, a customized machine that reflects the joy of cycling. It's All About the Bike follows Penn's journey, but this book is more than the story of his hunt for two-wheel perfection. En route, Penn brilliantly explores the culture, science, and history of the bicycle, from artisan frame shops in the UK to California, where he finds the perfect wheels, via Portland, Milan, and points in between. Jonathan Cowley performs the book and follows this serpentine path that explains our love affair with cycling.
Bicycle manufacturing emerged from its roots as a cottage industry to become big, big business. Bicycles were mass-produced on assembly lines for the first time. The design process was separated from production. Specialized factories supplied standardized components. One-third of all patents registered at the U.S. Patent Office in the 1890s were bicycle-related. In fact, the bicycle had its own dedicated patent building in Washington, D.C. At the 1895 Stanley Bicycle Show in London, the annual industry event, 200 firms displayed 3,000 models. The Cycle magazine reported 800,000 bicycles manufactured in Britain that year. Many locksmiths, gunsmiths, and anyone with metallurgy skills abandoned their trades and went to work in bicycle factories. In 1896, the peak year for production, 300 firms in the USA made 1.2 million bicycles, making it one of the largest industries in the country. The biggest firm, Columbia, with 2,000 employees at the Hartford Works in Connecticut, boasted of making a bicycle a minute. By the end of the decade, the bicycle had become a utilitarian form of personal transport for millions, the people's nag. For the first time in history, the working class became mobile. As they could now commute, crowded tenements emptied, suburbs expanded, and the geography of cities changed. In the countryside, the bicycle helped to widen the gene pool. Birth records in Britain from the 1890s show how surnames began to appear far away from the rural locality with which they had been strongly associated for centuries. Everywhere, the bicycle was a catalyst for campaigns to improve roads, literally paving the way for the motor car. The health benefits of the bicycle met with an appetite for self-improvement that characterized the age. The same workers who pedaled to the factories and the pits founded gymnastic clubs and choirs, libraries and literary societies. At the weekends, they cycled together in clubs. Amateur and professional racing exploded. Cycle racing at tracks or velodromes became the number one American spectator sport. Arthur A. Zimmerman, one of the world's first international sports stars, won over 1,000 races on three continents as an amateur, and then as a pro, including gold medals at the first World Cycling Championships in Chicago in 1893. In Europe, road racing became hugely popular. Long-lived classic races such as Liège to Bastogne to Liège and Paris to Roubaix were staged for the first time in 1892 and 1896 respectively. The Tour de France was inaugurated in 1903. Americans in particular became captivated by the idea of speed during the gay 90s. Speed was thought to be a mark of civilization. Through transportation and communication, Americans came to associate speed with the unification of their vast country. On a bicycle, they could actualize it. By the end of 1893, track races surpassed 35 miles per hour. The bicycle eclipsed the trotting horse to become the fastest thing on the road. Technological innovation made the bicycle even lighter and faster as the decade progressed. In 1891, Monty Holbein set the world 24-hour track record of 577 kilometers, 361 miles, at London's Herne Hill Velodrome. 6 years later, the cigar-smoking Dutchman, Mathieu Cordin, rode 400 kilometers, 250 miles further. A typical bicycle was fixed wheel, no gears or freewheel, with a steel frame, slightly dropped bars, a leather saddle, and usually no brakes. You braked by backpedaling. Roadsters commonly weighed around 33 pounds. Racers were under 22 pounds, pretty much the weight of the finest road racing bicycles today. On the 30th of June, 1899, Charles Murphy became the most famous cyclist in America when he rode a mile in 57.45 seconds, paced by a locomotive on the Long Island Railroad on planks laid between the rails. The bicycle met with the demand of fin de siècle society for independence and mobility. The safety introduced whole new groups to two wheels, the old and young, juvenile models were marketed from the early 1890s. The short and the unfit, men and women.
That was It's All About the Bike by Robert Penn. Bruce Wilk has been writing and lecturing about running injury management for more than 30 years. Bruce is certified in manual therapy and orthopedic physical therapy, and oh yes, he's completed 27 marathons and 4 Ironman triathlons. His primary practice is in Miami, where he is the director of the Orthopedic Rehabilitation Specialists. He and his wife also own the Runner's High, which has become one of the centers of Miami's running community. As I've shared before, I'm a race walker who's completed 10 half marathons. Along the way, Bruce has helped me manage my achy knees. Bruce has just published the Running Injury Recovery Program, a guidebook to treating your own running injuries. It's the culmination of Bruce's 30 years in the field. Welcome, Bruce. It's great to have you with us on the Book Report.
Thank you.
You are an incredibly busy professional. What was your impetus for writing this book?
To save runners' lives. But there's a lack of agreed-upon treatment management programs. There's a wide standard of care. And over my 30 years, I've treated runners who have suffered life-altering running injuries, not from a running injury, but from the medical management of a running injury.
I'm a race walker, not a runner, and I'm usually, to put it delicately, at the back of the pack. Is your book for me too?
Yes.
All right. How does one go about assessing your own injury?
The runner needs to understand it's not the type of injury that's critical, it's the severity. So in my book, I have developed a 5-stage scale, and each scale would have red flags, because stage 5 is pain that cripples you. Any type of running injury can be a crippling injury, and this is why I wrote my book. If a runner does not know how to navigate the medical system and doesn't know how to clear themselves as they get through the medical system, any crippling running injury can be a life-altering running injury, because by the nature of being an injured runner, you're a healthy person. When a healthy person enters the medical system, bad things can happen to them. And I treat many runners who have had complications from needless surgery that was based on MRI results and never treated the running injury, and they went through a nightmare. The same for cortisone shots. I've treated runners who have had nerve damage from cortisone shots. I've treated runners who have had fractures explode after cortisone shots while running. And so a healthy person can become a disabled person by over-aggressive medical management and the complications.
Okay, 2 questions come right to the forefront. Whether you're a walker or a runner, when you're in pain and you know you have some sort of an injury, how do you know whether to go to a sports medicine doctor or straight to your physical therapist?
In my book, I've devoted several chapters for runners to self-assess their needs and the quality of the medical intervention they're receiving. If you think you need professional help, get professional help, but then go in with your eyes open, assess what's going on, make sure the treatment meets up to a standard of care that's acceptable to you.
Okay. I was fascinated by something that you wrote, which you kind of alluded to earlier. Taking meds to feel better is not the same as actually getting better. Talk more about that.
Masking pain while doing strenuous activity is dangerous, but more importantly, most every medication, whether oral or injected, prescribed or over-the-counter, weakens your body. So you not only are taking medication that masks the pain, you're taking medication that potentially weakens your body while you're doing strenuous activity. That's a real red flag in my protocol.
Just from my own experience, when you finish a half marathon or even a 5K and you're achy the next day, are you saying kind of not to take, you know, pain med, just even some Advils and things like that?
Yeah, I recommend runners, injured runners, when they take medication orally, there's a 24-hour period sensation of not training. For injectable medication, it's at least 3 weeks. It varies individually, but I don't want them training through pain that they need to take medication for. On my one scale, it's one step from disaster. My pain scale also works for training. Okay, so for while injured, we're talking about an unusual, disconcerting pain. Now, there is normal pain of training. There is pain upon exertion. If a familiar known pain, that's the cost of doing business. With training hard, there's some pain at rest. We feel our legs. Pain during normal daily activities, getting out of a chair on the steps, is a little abnormal. I limit my athletes the bulk of their time to known pains while running, known pain some while recovering, not running, and very cautious pain that occurs to normal daily activities. The red flags are altering your stride, disturbing rest, and altering and modifying normal daily activities. Those require a period of recovery.
Readers, this is Elaine Charles. I'm speaking with Bruce Wilk about his new book, The Running Injury Recovery Program. If you develop osteoarthritis, does that spell the end of your running career?
Not necessarily. Osteoarthritis has different natures and different types, and I've helped many runners and race walkers continuing the care of continuing their training with arthritis. And the important thing for the listeners to understand, contrary to popular belief, there is no increased arthritis in a typical runner's legs and their spines. There's also data to show that lifelong running preserves your knees as well as lifelong walkers, and lifelong runners have less knee arthritis than the general population. It is not running that increases knee arthritis. It is surgery and trauma. Walking is the gold standard for osteoarthritis management, and I fight to keep my osteoarthritis running. There would be judicious use of medication for arthritis and training, but that would be on getting professional care and a great deal of caution of using the over-the-counter medications for arthritis and continuing to train. But there is a large place in professional care while you're monitored and paying attention to the other aspects of your body while you're managing your osteoarthritis, pain, and inflammation with medication and training. It would require professional care.
I wanted to get your opinion on selecting the right shoe. I know that's a huge topic.
There are shoes that can precipitate a running injury, an ill-fitting, worn-out, improperly designed, improperly manufactured shoes. And some manufacturers have gotten into trouble for making false claims about shoes fixing running injuries, especially barefoot running shoe technology. In my protocol, I have my runners using proper training shoes. I go through how to select that the shoe is properly designed, how to find that the shoe is properly manufactured, how you can analyze the shoe fits properly, and how you can assess the shoe functions right throughout the course of recovery. I try to use one good shoe through the whole course of recovery.
Bruce, I really want to congratulate you on the book. I've read it. It's easy to use. As I said, the graphs and the photos are amazingly helpful, and it's a great resource. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
If you've ever wanted to trek across France, and who doesn't, the book report has a title for you.
David LeVay's The Hairy Hikers, a coast-to-coast trek along the French Pyrenees. Fueled by a degree of midlife crisis and the need to escape the routine of modern life, David and Rob set out to walk from the Atlantic to the Mediterranean, taking in French villages, beautiful scenery, and one of the most spectacular mountain ranges in Europe. Just about perfect, if you can put aside the inevitable conflict, drama, and unexpected tedium that results from two men spending more than 7 weeks in each other's company. Rupert Farley narrates.
I hadn't mentioned anything to Nikki at this stage, although she knew that I was feeling a little stir-crazy and wanted to do something to haul myself, albeit temporarily, out of the clutches of suburbia and my somewhat stressful job as a child therapist. Over the years, I have banged on enough times about buying a house abroad, or living on a barge, or growing a beard and hiding in the woods down at our allotment. So, all in all, Nikki was well aware that I had the potential to do something stupid at some point in my life. I stumbled upon the GR10 itself whilst I surfed the net looking at walking holidays in France. And somehow the idea of a coast-to-coast walk that incorporated mountains, French villages, and beautiful scenery seemed just about perfect. I had always had something of a love affair with France, having spent many holidays there, both with Nikki and Jess, and with friends in my younger days. As for mountains, there is something very special about the intense sensation of height and space, the solitude and sense of escape, and the way in which they transform one's perspective, both externally and internally. They have always captivated me. So, with the idea half-forming in my mind, I bought a couple of books on the GR10, and the more I read, the more the feeling of wanting to embark on this mad adventure started to creep up on me, to the point where I started to become a little obsessed. I don't know if Nikki saw the book lying around, or whether I unconsciously kept it hidden away like some guilty secret, but my actual coming out, so to speak, could have been handled a little better. We were on a family holiday in Cornwall for a few days with a good friend of ours, and during a pleasant evening in the local pub over a couple of pints of Frenchman's Creek, I suddenly blurted out the fact that I had been thinking about taking 2 months off work, abandoning the family, buggering off to France and walking miles along some bloody mountains. That's not quite how I put it, of course, but it's fair to say that was the gist of the translation kindly provided for me by Nikki. And to be fair, while she didn't oppose the idea, she wasn't too impressed with the cowardly way in which I had told her about it. Over the next few months, the idea continued to crystallize, and one evening I mentioned it to my good friend Rob, who immediately declared his hand. "Count me in," he said. Now, Rob is a lovely chap, and a man of many talents. Builder, cook, singer, and guitarist, alongside a healthy dose of the more quirky and eccentric. Amongst his many talents, he is the world's number one Chitty Chitty Bang Bang fan, and knows by heart the words to all the songs, to which we have been subjected many times over dinner and a glass or two of red wine. Indeed, one of his numerous alter egos is Grandpa Potts, and his rendition of Posh is very fine. So when Rob said, "Count me in," I was very glad to have him on board, although I was a little anxious about how the two of us would manage such a long and intimate journey together. However, to be honest, the idea of doing the walk on my own was daunting, both physically and emotionally. So I welcomed the idea of Rob's company. To his credit, he had done a fair bit of long-distance mountain walking and orienteering over the years. Certainly, in this respect, he was much better qualified and equipped for this venture than I was. He also kindly volunteered to be my case study whilst we were away. I wasn't exactly sure what this meant, but I got the strange feeling that he knew something I didn't. Still, I thought, if Oliver Sacks can write The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, I can write The Man Who Walked the Pyrenees with Grandpa Potts. As time passed, the idea of the walk slowly became more of a reality in my mind, as opposed to some kind of wishy-washy abstract fantasy. The more people I spoke to about it, the more the possibility became a probability. It was as if the simple act of talking about it was enough to bring it gradually into being.
We've heard a sampling from David LeVay's The Hairy Hikers. If you loved Wild by Cheryl Strayed, the book report recommends AWOL on the Appalachian Trail. In 2003, software engineer David Miller left his job, his family, and friends to hike more than 2,000 miles of the Appalachian Trail. AWOL is Miller's account of his journey from Georgia to Maine. Listeners are treated to rich descriptions of the Appalachians, the isolation and reverie, the inspiration that fueled his quest, and the rewards of taking a less conventional path through life. While the book abounds with introspection and perseverance, it also provides useful info about hiking gear and planning. Not merely a travel guide, this is a beautifully written and highly personal view into one of the insights gained by abandoning what is comfortable and routine. Christopher Lane narrates.
My journey started with a walk that had my heart pounding and my legs burning. Sweat drenched my shirt and got in my eyes. 30 minutes, and I hadn't gone anywhere. That was a year ago on a treadmill after being turned down for a leave of absence to hike the Appalachian Trail. I was determined to hike in a year, even if it meant going AWOL. For over a year of training on a treadmill, I never got blisters, never went uphill so steeply I could touch the ground ahead of me, and never got rained on. All of these things beset me within days of starting my hike. Computer programming was the job from which I walked away. My last assignment put me in the dark corner of a little used building. On a good day, two or three people would pass by my desk. Other programmers seemed content to plug themselves into their machines, attached to the keyboard by their fingers, for 9 hours a day. When a programmer had an issue, he would get on the phone to another programmer 2 cubes away. I could hear both ends of the conversation. They could have heard each other without the phone. I felt out of place. I struggled to stay awake, propped my eyes open with cups of coffee, and fantasized about winning the lottery. If I had been given a leave of absence the first time I asked, it might have tempered my enthusiasm. Getting turned down solidified my resolve. I pondered the future. Would I continue reporting to a cube until retirement, with a few vacation days sprinkled in? After putting in 10 years with my current employer, I would start earning 3 weeks of vacation a year. Yippee! This is how it's done in middle-class America. Shouldn't I be thankful that life is as comfortable as it is? Most people are devastated if they lose their jobs. At the beginning of April in 2003, I broke the news to my boss. He said, "If you need to have a midlife crisis, couldn't you just buy a Corvette?" I appreciated him for putting me at ease with his humor. I even considered taking Corvette for a trail name. He was supportive and did all he could to get me a leave. It just wasn't part of corporate policy. As I tell my story, I will speak of other inspirations for my hike. In doing so, I am not contradicting myself. My job dissatisfaction was just one factor in my decision to hike the AT. Most thru-hikers, when asked, will offer up a single motivation. In part, it is the reason currently dominating his thoughts. In part, it is the type of answer that is expected. And in part, it is the type of answer that is easiest to give. It is not that simple. The reasons for a thru-hike are less tangible than many other big decisions in life, and the reasons evolve. Toward the end, possibly the most sustaining rationale to finish a thru-hike is the fact that you have started one.
We've just heard AWOL on the Appalachian Trail by David Miller. In 2007, Chrissy Wellington shocked the triathlon world by winning the Ironman World Championships in Hawaii. As a newcomer and a complete unknown, Chrissy's win shook up the sport. A Life Without Limits, a World Champion's Journey, is the story of her rise to the top, a journey that has taken her around the world, from a childhood in England to the mountains of Nepal, the oceans of New Zealand, the trails of Argentina, and finally, across the finish line. Wellington, who shares the narration with Polly Lee, offers a first-hand inspirational story of the incredible challenges she faced, anorexia, near drowning, and training with a very controversial coach. But to Wellington, the drama of the sport also presents an opportunity to improve your life.
I'd been cycling at a steady pace for nearly 100 miles. The barren road knifed through thick black lava fields that tolerated little in the way of life among their rocks. Every now and then, a bougainvillea bush would appear in splendid isolation on the roadside, but otherwise I just had the long white line I was following on the side of the road for company. The tropical sun was high overhead, so high that my bike and I cast barely any shadow, and the road stretched out ahead of me, now empty of cyclists. I was in the lead. I took a moment to allow this to sink in. I wasn't sure who the two girls I just passed were, because I knew barely anyone in this race. It might have been the World Championships of the most grueling single-day event in sport, but this was all new to me. The Pacific Ocean was royal blue to my right, and to my left rose the volcano of Hulalalai, shrouded in cloud. If you're lucky, the cloud cover extends down to the coast, but we were having no such luck, and the heat hung over the tarmac like a wicked spirit distorting the way ahead. It was just past midday. 5.5 hours earlier, our race had begun in the waters of that ocean. If everything went well, I could expect another 4 until the finish line. Officially, it was up past 90 in the shade. But out here, on this stark, naked road, it was over 100. And the wind was ferocious. Coming down off the volcano, it had already forced me once onto the rumble strips at the side of the road. It was frightening to cycle in such a crosswind. But it stripped you bare as well. This was like racing in a blast furnace. In a couple of hours' time, I would be back out here, this time on foot, well into the marathon that completes the day's activities. By then it would be even hotter. Would I still be in the lead? This was an Ironman triathlon. The Ironman triathlon. Every October, the World Championships of the sport are held in Kona on the island of Hawaii. An Ironman is the longest distance of triathlon. A 2.4-mile swim, 112 miles on the bike, and then you run a marathon. Unbeknown to me, 4 previous champions had by now dropped out of the race. In an Ironman, even the world's best face a challenge just to finish. I was in pole position. This didn't seem real. I don't think I'd ever struck anyone as obvious world champion material. For a start, there's my nickname. It's Muppet. And yes, it's pretty much for the reasons you would think. I've always been accident-prone and low on common sense. I was sports mad as a kid, but there was no sign of any unusual talent. But I've also been driven, for as long as I can remember, by a fierce determination to make the best out of myself and to try and make the best out of the world around me. 8 months earlier, I had given up my job in the civil service to become a professional triathlete. International development was my passion, but when the bureaucracy and red tape started to get me down, sport offered itself as a perfect way to get things moving again, both in terms of my own development and my ambitions to help others. I have seen how sport can empower people and cross boundaries.
That was A Life Without Limits by Chrissy Wellington. Readers, after the tragedy surrounding the Boston Marathon, I think this title will really inspire you. On the morning of December 22, 2005, New York City firefighter Matt Long was cycling to work when he was struck by a 20-ton bus making an illegal turn. The injuries he sustained nearly killed him. Miraculously, after 5 months in the hospital and more than 40 operations, Matt was able to begin his recovery. In addition to physical injuries, Matt found the psychological consequences of the accident nearly as hard to process. In the 18 months before the accident, he had competed in more than 20 premier athletic events and had qualified for running the most prestigious race, the Boston Marathon. After the accident, one doctor told him he'd be lucky if he could ever walk without a cane. The long run, one man's attempt to regain his athletic career and his life by running the New York City Marathon, is the emotional and incredibly honest story of Matt's determination to fight through fear, despair, loneliness, and intense physical and psychological pain to regain the life he once had. It chronicles Matt's road to recovery as he teaches himself to walk again and, a mere 3 years later, to run in the 2008 New York City Marathon. Matthew Del Negro narrates.
Egged on by a friend, Noel Flynn, I trained through the winter of 2004 for my first triathlon, a 1.5-kilometer swim, 40-kilometer bike, and 10-kilometer run, that spring. When I completed it, I couldn't wait for the next one, and the one after that. I got addicted to the competition and the training and the camaraderie among the athletes I met at different events. I joined a triathlon club. I tracked my mile split times and my heart rate after every workout. I logged the number of miles I put on my running shoes, retiring a pair when it hit 300. I consumed nutrition books. I started preaching that bagels are not your friends at family parties. I cut back on my beer intake, a huge concession for a guy who owns bars. And I started racing every chance I could. In 2004, my first full year of training, I did 14 triathlons of different lengths and traveled everywhere from Long Island to New Jersey to Texas to do them. The adrenaline rush from the training and the competing was like nothing I had ever experienced, except maybe the rush of running to a fire with my ladder company. And all the work paid off in other ways as well. I dropped to 175 pounds and the backache disappeared for good. Suddenly, I was in the best shape of my life. Then I made the ultimate commitment. I signed up for an Ironman, an event that can make waste of even the best athlete over the course of a 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike, and 26.2-mile run. It was in Lake Placid, New York, in July 2005, 4 months before the New York City Marathon. My training buddies thought I was nuts. Maddie, what's the rush? Frank Carino, a close friend and fellow firefighter, asked one day after we did a long, hard training run together. Frank had attempted his first Ironman only after competing in smaller ones for 5 years. The Ironman can take a huge toll on your body. You can build up slowly, you know. Frank, I know, but the thing is, I love this stuff, even when it hurts. No, there was no talking me out of it. On July 26, I did my first Ironman, finishing in 11 hours and 18 minutes, and in 279th place out of about 2,000 finishers. I did the marathon leg, the third and final one, in 3 hours and 44 minutes, nearly 9 minutes faster than my last solo marathon 7 years earlier. A pretty good showing, I thought. Pretty good? Frank said after we were done. That was fantastic. Maddie, you gotta slow down. You're catching up to me. You're definitely going to Kona someday. He was talking about Kona, Hawaii, site of the annual Ironman World Championship. Frank had qualified for the first time with his race in Lake Placid. For me, Kona would be a goal come 2006. First, I had to make it to Boston.
That was The Long Run by Matthew Long. Readers, I hope you found a title or two to kickstart your summer shape-up. As I've shared, your humble host has competed as a racewalker in more than 10 half marathons in the U.S., and now I'm training for one in Reykjavik, Iceland. It's a great way to see the country and now the world. And let me state without hesitation, I'm no athlete, but it's great fun to be out there. Look for more suggestions on my website, bookreportradio.com. And thanks so much for joining me today. And see you back here next week on The Book Report.